Crazy Buddhist, a conversation about Buddhist ideas, Buddhist teaching, Buddhism in the real world with Reverend Jerry Hirano. Hirano-sensei is the director of the Center for Buddhist Education for the Buddhist Churches of America. He is the minister at the Salt Lake Buddhist Temple in Salt Lake City, Utah, as well as supervising minister for temples in Ogden and Honeyville, Utah, and in Ontario, Oregon. Today's conversation includes Reverend Carmela Havaiana Hirano. Carmela is both a medical doctor, a psychiatrist, and an ordained minister in the Jodo Shinshu or Pure Land tradition, Buddhism. She is the minister's assistant at the Salt Lake Buddhist Temple, and she's been married to Jerry for the past 16 years. I'm Dan Bomas. Delighted you could join us. The whole crazy Buddhist idea came from one person who was a member of the congregation who really kind of wondered what the connection was between mental health and Buddhism. Yes. What was she hoping to learn?
Originally, I've gotten a lot of questions when people come to the temple, just asking about almost like counseling. Is Buddhism counseling and psychology? And I told them, no, it isn't. And then I had a younger priest write to me with questions that she had gotten from a student that came to her temple. And I told her that, you know, mental health counseling is very different than Buddhism itself. I said there's overlap, but Buddhism doesn't try to make you fit into, say, a sane or normal category. That there are a lot of famous Buddhists who probably, if you wrote them up, if Carmela wrote them up as a patient, would say, this person's crazy. And so that's what got the idea of crazy Buddhist.
And Carmela, you know, the first noble truth of Buddhism is that there is suffering. Everyone experiences it. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, based on my life experience, that there's no worse suffering than mental illness.
Well, it really depends on the mental illness, because there's a whole range of, severity. And even in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, Edition 5, we are required to state the severity of the illness. Well, it's assumed that when a person fulfills criteria for a psychiatric disorder, that they have a disorder. But there's mild, moderate, and severe. There's recurrent. There's partial remission, that kind of stuff. So really, in that sense, that's sort of what resonates with me when I incorporate Buddhist teachings into my practice, is what is the state of mind of this person right now? Because that really fluctuates over time. So sometimes they're really bad, and sometimes they're okay.
And how do you judge, then, the severity, and how do you judge the applicability of any Buddhist teaching in a given case?
Well, like you said, Dan, it starts with this premise that we all suffer as human beings. And I guess my approach now, and it's really sort of evolved over time, the more I study Buddhism, is that, one, the suffering has to be defined. The stories have to be told by the patient themselves. I hesitate to assume that they're mentally ill until they tell their story. And so I've had to take into account what their perspective of the truth of their personal experience is, of their suffering, and based on that, determine whether this is a mental illness or not. So really, for a good while, maybe a few sessions, we just listen to the stories that they tell me, and then we go from there. But where I eventually draw the line between providing information, psychoeducation, books to read, that kind of thing, is really how their perspective of the reality of their suffering interferes with their, quote, normal functioning. You know, things like sleeping and eating and interacting with people, their primary relationships, being able to function at work. Because if they subjectively feel pain, emotional, mental, psychological pain, it does not necessarily mean they're dysfunctional. So to me, that indicates that there's a degree of resiliency there where they could put their mental pain in a certain perspective so that they can still carry on their normal lives, if you will.
And Jerry, what are some of the other questions?
Well, for myself, the thing that bothered me is I was reading that someone was asking, should I take medication for my mental illness or should I just sit? And I was like, take the medicine. You know, meditation, just sitting there, might make it worse for you. So like Carmela leads the meditations and things at my temple for that exact reason. People think meditation is just like you have the new byword Zen. Oh, it's so Zen, meaning they're so chill or so calm. Meditation can be very intense. And so I always recommend you should go to someone. If you're going to start Buddhist meditation, go to a master, a Zen master who knows how to deal with it. Because we do it at our temple to calm the mind, to listen to the teachings. Sitting isn't really a practice of Jodo Shinshu. But I told Carmela, if we're going to start this meditation service where we chant and we sit, if the person in sitting has an episode, I don't really know how to deal with that type of thing. I said, Carmela did Zen for quite a while, Zen meditation, and at a Zen temple. But as a psychiatrist, I figured she's much more adept at handling any episode that might come out from that meditation.
Well, it raises the question, Carmela, is Buddhist practice, meditation included, a useful technique for treating any kind of mental illness?
I think so. Oh, I definitely think so. And that is based on my conviction that when people look at their suffering and they go into great depths exploring the origin of their suffering, that they can understand Noble Truth number two, which is the cause of their suffering. What is it that they're desiring that is not happening? Or what is it that they are not desiring that is there? So the moment they can realize those two aspects of their suffering, what's there, what's not there, what's excessive, what's not enough, they can somehow come to a better understanding about where they want to go with it.
Well, that assumes kind of an emotional maturity in the subject that a lot of people, I think, don't really have. They just know that I hurt and I'm mad at everybody because of it.
Yeah. So again, we are alluding to acuity and severity. When they cannot see any light at the end of the tunnel at all, and they're hopeless, they're helpless, there is no way out, they're basically painted into a corner. To me, that's acute and that's dangerous, and they need to go to the hospital.
Do you find that there's a lot of people who look to Buddhism for, you know, everything from just basic self-help to the end-all and be-all of what I need to fix my life?
No, not to really to that extent, but a lot of new patients who I evaluate have heard and or practice a little bit of, quote, mindfulness meditation. And so we discuss that in their treatment plan about what that means to them and to what extent they want to be coached in that approach.
But it's not really part of your Jodo Shinshu teaching.
No, it isn't. Jodo Shinshu doesn't talk about a practice to improve yourself in that way. Jodo Shinshu tells you to look at yourself, but to see So it kind of fits into what Carmela is talking about. You evaluate how much the world has given you. So in reality, it's not what is the world supposed to give to me? It's all these things I've received from the world. Actually, my entire existence is something that I have to be grateful for. And that's the main focus of Jodo Shinshu.
Now, some patients are not there when they start work with me, because at that point in time in their process, I call it a process, their mental suffering, emotional suffering might be too intense that all they could do is focus on the suffering self. And that's okay. I think it's important that people's emotional anguish need to be validated and recognized as real. And really, at that stage in their treatment, probably one of the most helpful things that occur, well, not just with the patient, but also with me, is to just listen to the stories that they tell. Because when they tell me the obstacles that they run into and the frustrations and the losses and all of that, they also get to hear themselves. And to me, that part right there is therapeutic already.
Well, sometimes when I listen to myself, I discover that I'm ridiculous.
Yeah, that too. That's important to recognize as well. Absolutely.
I think that's for Buddhas, as a Buddhist teaching, the ability to look at yourself and laugh at it, I think is very important. That's why if you listen to a lot of priests or monks or teachers in that way, they're pretty funny people because they've had to look at their lives very carefully and go, oh, I'm a fool.
Well, fool is okay in Jodo Shinshu, I'm told.
Right.
But for people with depression, that is a very difficult idea to embrace because they don't have enough ego strength to acknowledge that part of themselves. You know, they tend to be very guarded and they want relief, they want positive feedback, right? And so when they're not yet at that stage where they could seriously look at themselves, identifying those deficient parts of the self can be very threatening. And it can break them. So we don't go there quite yet.
Do you teach skills then in treatment? And of course, you prescribe medications as necessary, but do you teach people how to confront some of their internal mental processes, that what in Buddhism is called skillful means?
I don't know that I teach necessarily. To me, teaching is kind of presumptuous because when I work with somebody, I cannot pretend to know what they already know. In fact, they know more about their predicament than I do. And so to me, it's a little bit silly to think about teaching coping skills. The way I think about it is that people have inherent coping skills to begin with. You know, just as we are equipped with the capacity to suffer, we are also equipped with the capacity to see our own suffering in a kind and compassionate way. That is my initial assumption, unless I run across somebody who's just not going to work with their process. But one thing that I do, which maybe could be expedient means, is I'd like to point out what their strengths are as they are suffering. For example, they tell me, oh, I just can't get out of bed. And so I tell them, well, you got out of bed today. That's why we can talk. Like that, they miss these clues, which I think are really important for their mental health, because there is a pattern of self-deprecation that can go so deep that they themselves believe that when they are devalued by their suffering or by other people, and they fall right for it. They believe that that's true. And that's only partially true. So we have to explore all those other truths that maybe they haven't even thought of before. And to me, ultimately, it has to come to a balance of seeing the negative and the positive, the yin, the yang, the dark and the light, that sort of thing. Because if they're stuck on one side or the other, then it's hard to achieve any sort of perspective. And really, for me, that's enough. If they can see both sides of their existence, this non-dual approach, even if it's theoretical, to me, that is quite an achievement.
Jodo Shinshu is kind of a wide-open approach to Buddhism in which you basically can say the hard work has already been done, and all I have to do is accept what's been done on my behalf. How does that work?
That's a good way to put it. You're embraced as you are. That's a big point in Jodo Shinshu, is that you look at your life and you realize that I'm not perfect. I have all these faults. That's why there's been actually friends of mine who says, I don't know if Jodo Shinshu will work in the United States, because they said they think in America, you want to be the top, you want to be the best, you know, this is the best thing. Whereas Jodo Shinshu kind of says, well, you're not the best, but that's okay.
And even if you are, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, right, exactly. So Jodo Shinshu is really trying to see how the entire world is embracing you. The good, the bad, everything is a miracle for you to have been brought here. The good as well as the bad.
And how does that work from a psychological perspective, Carmela? Is that a useful, helpful perspective?
Oh, yes. Over time in my practice, I've come to realize that before they see me for the first time, they've already been through a lot. I'm working with a fairly severe population right now that we're providing treatment with repeated transcranial magnetic stimulation. And when I review their psychiatric histories, their depression goes back to childhood. So by the time they come for a psychiatric evaluation, they've already worked through a lot of the wranglings in their own minds. And it takes an enormous amount of courage for them to finally get to see a psychiatrist, because no one wants to see a psychiatrist. No one wants to be labeled mentally ill. So by the time they present themselves for the first time, they've already been embraced in that compassion to get them to the point of finally seeking treatment.
Now, the young woman who provided you with this set of questions that we've been looking at, ask some questions about some serious psychiatric disorders, sociopathy and borderline personality disorder and things like that must make it difficult, if not impossible, to work with someone. After all, the first step in making any kind of progress is taking responsibility for the place that you're in. And some people are not prepared to do that.
Mm-hmm. That is true. I never really know, honestly, at what point they take a turn. Because considering how much time they spend with me, usually it's an hour for a therapy hour, like maybe twice a month, some of them once a month. The rest of the time, they're just living their lives. So there are multiple mysterious causes and conditions that affect their mental health. So I can only go back to the research data, and really, for the most part, people who are diagnosed with borderline personality, in my opinion also, is that one, they have to be old enough to warrant a diagnosis of a personality disorder, and therefore I'm very careful not to make that diagnosis in adolescents, because they haven't lived their lives long enough. Their brains haven't even matured, for goodness sake. You know, that usually happens right around the second half of their 20s. But borderline personality typically stems back to childhood trauma, invariably.
And how does it manifest?
Well, anger. Typically anger, rage. It's a very strong but very primitive defense, ego defense, it's denial, it's projection. I'm not mentally ill. You are. You are making me miserable. It's your fault. But the rage can be so intense because it's necessary to keep the ego that's been abused, that's been ravaged, really, from falling apart. So rage is a very powerful defense mechanism that keeps people away at a safe distance.
And Jerry, does Jodo Shinshu have any kind of a prison ministry or a ministry that reaches out to people who have had just really traumatic psychological experiences in their lives?
There, here in the United States, there were priests who would go to prisons. But in Japan, it's kind of interesting that you mention that, because there is a form of therapy. It's a secular practice, but it's based on Jodo Shinshu, called Nikon. And it's used a lot in prisons. And I don't know if you know Nikon. It's very simple. It's just asking yourself to, and Carmela happens to be certified as an Nikon counselor also, and we've done Nikons
day retreats
at the temple, and we've actually did a three-night retreat.
Intensive,
before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's to ask yourself...
Three questions?
Yeah.
What have I received from others? What have I given others? And what troubles and difficulties have I caused others?
So it's the purpose is to really look at yourself. It's a very old practice called Mishirabe, which literally means to look at the self. And it was a type of meditation where you go into a cave and you just look at your life.
Kind of like the monk who brought Buddhism from India to China. What was his
Bodhidharma.
Name? Bodhidharma.
Yeah, yeah.
Dharma. Faced the wall for 9 years.
Right, right. It's very, but, you know, you're asked, the guy who brought it back into this current form called Nikon was a man by the name of Isshin Yoshimoto, and he was a businessman. And he read about this, and he tried it on himself. And as a businessman, he was used to seeing how much goods he put out, how much he got back. And he says he did that with his life, and he realized that he's so much in the red. He's given so little, but he's received so much. And so in the prisons, it's almost set up because traditional Nikon is a little room. You just sit by yourself. So in the prisons, these people are almost set up to be in this situation. And they can reflect on these three questions in many different perspectives.
How do you learn more about it? How to do it?
Well, I did my Nikon training at the Toto Institute in Moncton, Vermont. And that was a week-long retreat, solitary retreat. There was, I think, four of us in that little farmhouse. And we had our own little enclosed space called a hoza. And we were there from 7 in the morning until about 9 or 10 at night, doing nothing but self-reflection on these three questions. And
do you take notes? Do you write things
yes,
down? Do you,
okay. Yes, they gave us a journal to write and a box of tissues. For me, that was very intense because they took us on this journey from reflecting on our mothers first. And it comes in these developmental stages. So we are asked three questions. What have I received, given, troubles that I caused, from birth until age 3. So you can imagine all the care that an infant baby would receive from mother and really not give anything back. I mean, what does a baby give back? What? Gurgles? Bubbles?
Smiles?
Smiles, right? But then if you look at all the care that that infant received from mother, it's endless. We were asked to compute how much money was spent on us, right? On diapers and medical care and clothing and all of that, right? And then the third question, what troubles and difficulties have I received? I mean, to me, that's really what cleared the air for me. It's like, oh my gosh, I kept my mom up all night. you know, I spit on her, I pooped on her, you know, things like that. And then we go through these developmental stages from 3 to 7 and 7 to 11, teenage years, early adult, in decades of years until the present. And I'll tell you, I mean, I used up the whole box of tissues. I felt so incredibly guilty about what I did to my mother, and yet unconditionally loved.
I mean, does that seem psychologically healthy to realize what a pain I've been to my parents?
You know, it's not for weak egos, certainly. I'm very careful about that approach with my traumatized patients because they blame themselves to begin with already for the trauma, and so they just cannot bear that heaviness of self-recrimination. It will destroy them. So sometimes when I do Nikon on PTSD people, we only focus on questions 1 and 2.
And Jerry, how does regular practice, I want to say, cover that? Because it seems like the Jodo Shinshu practice is kind of an umbrella that you go in for shelter. How does Jodo Shinshu practice cover the psychological trauma that none of us can avoid and all of us bring with us?
Well, I don't think that if you're talking about practice, most people think, well, if you go to the temple, that's my practice. Actually, I would say your life is your practice. So all the time, no matter what you're doing, you focus on, wow, they did that for me. They did this for me. And you look at these things that make you grateful. When you come to the temple and we chant, like I said, we chant when you come to my temple and then you listen to the Dharma. But the chanting is the releasing. You're expressing gratitude for all the things that actually happen. So I've told people, because they think of Jodo Shinshu and they equate it with Zen, and they think that the sutra chanting that we do open something up. Actually, the sutra chanting, which is an expression of gratitude, is to express gratitude for the awakening that hopefully has already happened from the practice of your life, going with this mindfulness of gratitude.
My daughter likes to pray the rosary when she's having difficulty and can't think of anything else to do. Would that be a comparable practice?
Carmela would know better. I'm not sure what you do at the rosary since I've never been Catholic, but Carmela was Catholic.
So. Yeah, you might say so, because the rosary is repetitive and it is devotional by nature. So yeah, I would say it's very similar.
I think you don't know exactly what you're saying all the time when you chant, like we talked mm-hmm. about last time, how it's just the power of knowing this is an act of gratitude. I would say the rosary, from what I could think, it's a, like, on the movies that I know, go say 10 Hail Marys, yes. Do this and this and
yes.
this,
mm-hmm.
right? It's that same thing they're expressing with voice or in their mind. Repentance.
Repentance, praise, joy, gratitude.
I mean, is the sound of doing it
right
useful?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
For example, when have you observed that?
Well, I think I mentioned a friend of mine, his name is Sonam, he was a very high Tibetan monk, and he actually went through a lot of these practices, like 3 years of isolation in meditation practice, but then he became a Jodo Shinshu priest, and he has one of our Jodo Shinshu Honganji temples in Kathmandu, quite a big temple. And he's the one who emphasizes it, because he says that when Tibetan Buddhism, they talk a lot about sound, the power of the sound, the power of the name. And there's been people here in the U.S., I've had people say that we say Namo Amida Butsu. And they've said, that's kind of hard to say. Can't we say it in English? And so I was at a seminar with Sonam, and someone asked that. And he goes, absolutely not. He goes, that sound has been cultivated and perfect it over millennia. And he says, for us to think, oh, I just can't say it right, is totally negating the power of the sound alone.
There is a Korean mantra, Mirikjon Yorebul, that is specific to one Buddhist group in Korea. And I once read their book, and at that point, I knew what it meant. But then I lost the book. And I kept the mantra. And after my wife died, I would go to that, Mirikjon Yorebul. And one morning when I was in the radio station very early, a woman who was part of the janitorial staff came in and asked me what I was doing. And I just said, well, this is something I say when I feel sad. Mirikjon Yorebul.
I bet you it sounds, because in a lot of Korean shows I hear them say, they're saying Namo Amida Butsu in their own language. And I bet you that Mida, that sounds, yeah, is Amida.
Well, no, it's Miruk.
Oh, Miruk.
So, yeah, but I'm sure there's an equivalent phrase in Korean. That may not be it. But
yeah, but they say, because I know they say Namo Amida Fu or Namo Kanzen Bosat, which is very much the same thing. But I think that sound, like you said, it just comes out. I was shocked myself for the first time it ever just popped out of my mouth was when my mom died. I was on a plane, and I was kind of half asleep, and I imagined her in her room, because I was coming home from, I'd just become a priest, and I was in San Jose at my temple, and she was dying of cancer. My sister called and says, you better get home right now. So I'm on this plane, home, and I just had this feeling, and I just was thinking of my mom. And then in my mind, I said, it's okay, Mom. You don't have to wait for me. You know. And boom, just came out of my mind. It was kind of embarrassing because I'm on an airplane with people around me, and I'm just startled out with just coming out of my mouth.
Carmela, do you find that people have breakthroughs that are associated sometimes with you know, if not a mantra or a rosary or something like that, but with practices that they can hold on to that become their own and aren't necessarily, you know, in the diagnostic manual?
Yeah, I think that there's a few who have sort of come up with their own comfort words, if you will. Well, I think some of them sort of learn them from me because I have signs all over my office, and one of them is let go or be dragged. So they write it down and they practice that if they want to practice letting go of whatever it is. Another one is want less, suffer less. Yes, oh, that's so cool. I've got to write that down. One of my patients who has really been struggling with his inner world, not so much his outer world because it's an amazing professional, but his inner world is just wrought with anguish and fear and trauma that goes way back his early childhood. We experimented with meditation. Well, actually waking up to a certain word that summarizes that particular meditation that he did that day. And he would come up with words like peace or frustration or pain. As a way of recognizing his reality. So I guess in a way, when people can put words into a very complicated set of emotions, it can somehow make a little bit more sense to them. So yeah, I guess in that way it can be helpful.
So these words are tools that you can use to your benefit.
Right.
Or at least, I don't know, there's a Buddhist mala, isn't there, with 108 beads?
Yeah, a traditional mala will have 108 beads. We call it Nenju in our tradition.
Okay, yeah. Explain what that's for.
Well, it's, in other traditions, it's just like a rosary. In fact, I've heard that the rosary came from the Buddhist mala. When a lot of these Buddhist gestures came into Catholicism from Alexander going to India. And when they came back, for instance, prayer, this the symbol of namaste, putting your hands together, that you see Indian people do, that has always been a very Buddhist and mudra of putting left and right together.
Mudra meaning a hand position.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so I was told that before Alexander's time, prayer was always with the outstretched arms, like the Joshua trees. When they found this gesture, they go, that's such a peaceful gesture. So that became more the gesture of prayer. And same with the rosary, Buddhists always use it to count. So if it was a traditional one that had 808, they would know, because there's a big bead on a small bead, they would know the different places they're at. So they would know how much they've recited something. And so that works for the Catholic rosary. So that's where I had heard that the Catholic rosary came from.
Let's get back to kind of evaluating yourself psychologically. I'm sure everybody can use a little therapy.
Mm-hmm.
To even if you just want to answer the question, am I okay?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the question is no, but so.
Yeah, it's okay to not be okay.
But how can people use some of these ideas that we've been talking about to kind of evaluate themselves and say, you know, I have misery and difficulty in my life, but I don't think I'm unique in that way, and how can they use some of these ideas to kind of evaluate themselves?
I think that for the most part, my patients, and really a lot of human beings for that matter, just naturally look at themselves, especially when they're alone. In fact, some of them obsess so much about themselves. They basically live in their own thoughts, in their own minds. But it depends on the conversation that they have with themselves. So when people are clinically depressed, that conversation is typically very self-deprecating and very put up, very critical of the self. And I think when they realize that it becomes a prison for them that they want to escape, that's when they bring it to therapy. Because it really is painful to see yourself as broken and defective and imperfect and complaining. It's very hard, I think, for an ego to take, seeing oneself in that way. And so that's where I think the therapeutic intervention can really help, is to train patients, if you will, to turn their attention not just to that specific tunnel that they're trapped in, but to look outside of it as well. So you brought up the issue of teaching earlier. I would probably say it's more like hand-holding or coaching maybe. So some of my patients would obsess about, oh, their fear of earthquakes, something like that. And so part of the strategy here is for them to also see the reality, the concrete mundane reality that there is no earthquaking right now. And so we work with this attention and look at the trees and the walls and the pictures on the walls and the floor and ascertain that, you know, there's no earthquake here. And that can be very reassuring for them because they often get so trapped in their own minds and believe their thoughts that it just becomes a spiral downward.
All right, Jerry, drawing to a close here, how would you, if you were speaking to a parishioner, I guess, and I don't know what the correct word for a
member of the Sangha.
Member of the Sangha. How would you advise them to kind of close their thought process? Would you ask them to chant? Would you ask them to recite? To say the Nanbutsu, what would you advise someone to do?
You know, for most who've come to the temple, they're used to saying the Nimbutsu. So I would say, yeah, just say it in the morning when you get up. Because in Jodo Shinshu, the only practice, if there is a practice, is in Japan, most people have an altar at home. They don't come to the temple, right? So when they wake up in the morning, they're just going in front of that altar. And examples of my father, he wasn't a priest, like I explained to you. But when I was even in my bedroom in the morning, I could hear him. Boing, he would just hit the little bell that's on the altar. And I know he's just going, Namamido, it's a, and he hit that bell. But it's that, just that little moment of silent reflection. He could say Namamida Butsu, you could say thank you. Like, I don't know, you could say pretty much anything you want. Like, I've often used the example that Meister Eckhart, who isn't Buddhist, he's a very famous Christian theologian, he said that thank you was the most important prayer you could say. You know, it's more than any of these other words, just that idea of gratitude. And so if someone said they want something, I says, just when you get up in the morning, go, well, thank you, I'm still here.
I remember Gordon B. Hinckley, the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, saying something very similar. He said, you know, when you're my age, he was 95, waking up in the morning is a significant thing.
Now, I think all of us who've been through, like you've been through serious illness, I've been through serious illness, you really understand that, wow, when you wake up in the morning, it's a gift. It's like, wow, I'm still here.
You know, along those lines about thank you, that's sometimes how I gauge whether my patients are getting better, is that when we end our session and they say thank you, it reassures me that they are not quite as caught in their suffering like they used to. So we end our session with mutual thank yous. And to me, that's amazing, that there's a turning of the corner here.
All right, well, thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Jerry Hirano is the minister at the Salt Lake Buddhist Temple in Salt Lake City, Utah. He was born and grew up in Utah. He's also the minister at the temples in Ogden and Honeyville, Utah, and in Ontario, Oregon. And he's director of the Center for Buddhist Education for the Buddhist Churches of America. Hirano Sensei's education includes degrees from the University of Utah and the Institute of Buddhist Studies in Berkeley, California, as well as advanced training and ordination at the Central Buddhist Seminary in Kyoto, Japan. Dr. Carmela Javayana Hirano comes from the Philippines, where she grew up and attended medical school. She did her residency in psychiatry at Ohio State University, and she works full-time in private practice in Bountiful, Utah. She was ordained as a Buddhist minister in Kyoto, Japan in 2014, and serves the Salt Lake Buddhist Temple in Salt Lake City. Jerry and Carmela have been married for 16 years. I'm Dan Bomas, and we're grateful you've taken the time to listen to Crazy Buddhist. Please leave us a rating or a review, and we'll be back soon.